You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 60, There's No Escape From This. Today on the program, we did some follow-up from last week's episode about the Nintendo Switch and some additional things that have now come to light that we didn't know about last week. And for the majority of this episode, we talk about Thursday's Apple event where they finally announced new MacBook Pros and, unfortunately, no updates to the iMac or Mac Pros, much to the chagrin of many Apple nerds. And at the tail end of the episode, a little bit about the new Microsoft Studio all-in-one desktop computer with multi-touch display, which is incredibly impressive. And if you have not seen that, you should really check out the commercial that they did, and you'll find the link in the show notes. And now the show.
So we have a Nintendo update for everybody. They have announced that they will be revealing all further details about the Nintendo Switch on January 12th, and that's taking place at the largest convention center in Japan. It will be an invite-only event. However, the weekend afterwards, immediately afterwards, they will be holding the first ever hands-on demos for the Nintendo Switch at the same location. So we will know exactly what it is when it comes out and how much it costs in a little under 3 months. There was also a report out earlier this week suggesting that the Nintendo Switch will in fact have a multi-touch screen. The interesting part of that report is that the screen on the Nintendo Switch is actually a 6.2-inch screen that is at a resolution of 720p. So, crunching the numbers, that translates to 330 ppi, meaning that the Nintendo Switch is indeed a high DPI or Retina display, which is great news because it'll be the first high DPI device Nintendo has ever released. All of their 3DSs, DSs, the Wii U, Fisher-Price tablet, all of them have had incredibly low screen density, so it will be extremely nice to finally play Nintendo games on a high-resolution, high-density display, presumably with incredibly good color depth compared to previous hardware that they've built. So you get to tool around playing Zelda on a Retina screen. It's going to be fantastic.
I had some concerns last week when we talked about this with the resolution of the screen, but based on what you're saying and the information that we currently have, I'm thinking it might be less of an issue. So I'm hoping that that the display looks as good as they're making it out to be.
Yeah, if this information is correct, the Nintendo Switch is effectively an iPad mini that's a bit thicker, has a vent on the top, and has two awesome controllers that click into it on either side. In fact, based on the dimensions of a 6.2-inch screen, plus the approximate size of the Joy-Con controllers, I'd say once you've clicked them into the tablet, the entire device probably has a similar profile to the iPad mini. That device, of course, has a 7.2-inch screen. So if you imagine an iPad mini and then kind of turn the left and right sides into controllers, that's effectively what we're talking about here. So it's actually probably smaller than it appears to be in the trailer.
Yeah, I mean, well, things always look deceiving when you look at commercials, right? It's hard to really judge what that product is going to look and feel like until you actually get it in your hands.
Yeah, exactly. So I think basically we're going to have a really comfy iPad mini with a Retina screen that you can play Zelda on the bus. And that is perfect. So that's Nintendo. Obviously,
and there's, by the way, and just to add on that, is there not some kind of video that they're announcing for? No, they announced something for January.
Yeah.
February.
Yeah. That's the event. So that's when they'll be revealing all the details. Yeah. So that's the event in January that they're going to have. They've also seemingly hinted that there will be more accessories for the Switch. So whether that translates to additional configurations of the Joy-Con, things like that, who knows? But yeah, I mean, anything at this point is speculation until that event. So we'll just have to wait. Open our New Year's present. Well, it's a week or two from New Year's, but
it's actually not that far off.
No.
But speaking of presents, why don't we get into the Apple event from, was it yesterday or was
Thursday.
Okay. So it was on Thursday.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about, so we're going to have to try to condense it in under an hour.
Yeah, I don't know how much there is to talk about. It's like,
well, there are probably plenty of people that haven't even seen the event. So let's actually just run through exactly what they announced.
We'll recap. So first, the Apple TV, they announced a new app called TV that only really matters if you're in the States. It will be out in December, starting in the US, with a tvOS update. And essentially, it reconfigures the functionality of tvOS. You know that TV button on the Siri remote? It will now jump to the TV app when you press it. So it's effectively like a home button now. And it will give you at a glance all the shows you're currently watching and shows it thinks you'll like. And that is embedded across pretty much every media app on tvOS, with the notable exception of Netflix. Probably because Netflix doesn't want to share their data with Apple. And I don't blame them. I mean, that stuff is the secret sauce that allows them to make new original content that everybody loves. So it makes sense that they wouldn't really want to share any of their data sets with Apple, because that's what this seems to require. So that it can, like, recommend things on Netflix to watch, show you your list, etc. Like, I don't know. Maybe between now and then they'll cave and it'll be included, but I wouldn't count on it, let's say. So the app is effectively a big fancy TV guide smashed together with Apple Music. It's very similar to Apple Music. It has that large text, large image, editorial UI that's being used throughout iOS 10. It has a For You section where it recommends things. It has the list of things you're watching. You can jump right into the next episode. It can tell you if there's a new episode coming up soon. For example, if you have HBO Go on your Apple TV, it'll tell you, oh, hey, this is when the new episode of Game of Thrones is out, etc. And they also announced live TV. It's all baked into Siri, so you can be like, hey, Siri, start watching NBC News, and it'll just put it on if it's an app you have that's capable of displaying live television. And they're finally going to be launching single sign-on for cable subscription, so you'll only have to sign in and prove you have a cable subscription one time, and then all the apps will tie into that.
And all of this stuff is US only for the beginning, right?
More or less, yeah.
I don't think we're getting a single sign-on right away here in Canada.
Yeah, our cable, everything is just completely fucked. Like, we have nowhere near the level of quality that the States has. Like, even though we only have like three or four big cable companies, just like in the States, theirs are so much further ahead than us. Plus, they didn't have an opportunity to do the scummy deals that ours have. Well, so
they're far ahead. I just want to touch on that though before we move on. They're far ahead in what ways?
Well, just in that the platform capability for single sign-on to work is viable. Like, they were just able to bring that in and it works. Here, it's a lot more complicated because of various tech stacks, and really our telecoms are just awful. That's really what it boils down to. Which brings me to my next point, which is that in the States, the telecoms didn't have an opportunity to create exclusivity contracts with various cable channels. So in Canada, and I think I've mentioned this before, but in Canada, HBO is not owned by HBO. The right to display HBO content online is actually owned by Bell.
That makes no sense to me.
Yeah. They did a deal with HBO a while ago, and as a result, they're the only ones that are allowed to stream HBO shows. As a result, it is impossible for HBO Go to come to Canada.
Do you know why that was allowed? Because that doesn't make any sense to me.
Because the CRTC is full of telecom execs who allow things to happen.
But the CRTC's...
they're supposed to be our telecommunications watchdog. They're supposed to bring in rules that make sure that the telecoms are playing on an even field.
Right. So that's why I don't understand that.
Because when execs from telecoms retire or leave, guess where they go? They end up getting positions at the CRTC. So major conflicts of interest there. It's not in their best interest to go against their former companies. They essentially give them free rein for the most part. To their credit, though, recently they've been doing a better job. Maybe they got rid of some of those people. I don't know. But they've seemingly been doing a better job lately. But it's still nowhere near enough to kind of turn things around in this country as far as telecommunications is concerned. So, I mean, things are kind of in dire straits in Canada when it comes to that stuff. I mean, phone bills are insanely high. Cable bills are insanely high. Internet bills are insanely high. And they provide far less value than plans in the States. Like, I've seen plans at T-Mobile and AT&T that would make people in Canada cry. And... I'm sure most people in Canada are aware of those plans and the prices and the amount of data you get. It's just unfortunate we don't have many alternatives here. I mean, with phones, there's Wind, but their network isn't as good as the other companies. So it's kind of a trade-off at this point, but I digress. It seems like a great set of features for tvOS. We won't be able to enjoy them, but people in the States will, and it looks pretty cool.
And was that... I still haven't watched the event. So was that all for Apple TV?
Yes.
Okay. So...
And the TV app will also be made available on iOS. So iPad, iPhone, etc. It looks the most impressive on the iPad. I think it's supposed to replace the video app. So it'll keep track of all the things you bought on iTunes and all that stuff. Like, it'll no longer be video.app where it's just a list.
Yeah, it's not that exciting. But
yeah. So it's now actually going to be this TV app that has everything. Which I kind of hope is the beginning of the end for iTunes being so monolithic. Like, it would be really cool if the TV and movies parts of iTunes were actually ripped out, and we got a TV app for Mac as well.
Yeah. I think people have been wanting them for a while.
Like, iTunes should just be for music. So the fact that they're creating this app just for movies and television, it just makes sense. So hopefully it makes sense to them too.
Well, one can hope that they've been working on that for a while. It's probably easier said than done. They're dealing with a lot of legacy stuff that needs to be reworked, right?
Oh yeah.
So moving on.
Yeah.
Do we want to move on to the new MacBooks?
Yes, we will. We will talk about the exclusive at Harrods triple gold plated MacBook Pros. Oh wait, no, they have none of those things. They just cost a lot.
I think we could, actually, before we even get to exactly what they announced, I should say that pretty much everything that we've been talking about for the last, whatever, month or two, based on all the rumors and based on your own predictions, pretty much we got what we thought we were going to get.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much. I mean, it's a MacBook Pro. They replaced the Function Row with an OLED touch bar, exactly as was predicted. Has Touch ID, exactly as was predicted. It's about as thin as a MacBook Air now, and it weighs 3 pounds.
What I did not expect, though, was the escape key on the keyboard to be physically missing.
Oh, well, I mean, the escape key is part of the Function Row, so you replace the Function Row, that goes too. Luckily, the escape key will be present on the touch bar in most cases. So, I mean, this is a great piece of hardware. They've done an insane job making this thing thinner and lighter and yet maintain the same amount of power and battery.
Right.
Some nerds, obviously, are extremely upset that there's not 32 gigs of RAM in it or whatever. But if you're talking about that kind of power, you really need an iMac or a Mac Pro, which they did not announce at the event. People are also upset about that, but don't worry, that's coming.
We'll get to that, but we should actually really talk about a lot of the innovations that they made in this new MacBook Pro. I almost said Mac Pro there, Freudian slip, because in addition to the OLED touch bar, which is really, really awesome, the screen is, from what I read, 30% more power efficient.
Yeah, they essentially crammed a giant iPad Pro panel in there. It's DCI P3, wide color gamut.
Right.
It's
brighter.
It's IGZO, which is the same panel tech that's being used in the iPad Pro. Like, they basically cut a larger version of the iPad Pro panel and put it into this MacBook.
And I know a lot of nerds specifically care about how cool and quiet laptops from Apple run the new fan design, and it's completely all new. It has an asymmetrical fan blade design.
Well, I mean, they've had asymmetric fan blades for a while.
It's new to that, but to the MacBook Pro. They did not have that fan design in last year's model.
Well, the thing is, it's not just asymmetric. It's a new design. So they've actually got a dual channel fan system. So there are vents on the sides of the new MacBook
on
Pro
on either side
that draw cool air in. And because of the asymmetric qualities of the fans, they actually pull that air in as they spin. Mm-hmm. And then it heats up as it moves through the fan, and then it gets pushed out the back.
But the actual asymmetric blades themselves, the way they're designed, they also run quieter because of that, right? They're not actually as turbulent when they're moving.
Asymmetric fan blades are quieter than symmetrical ones.
It'd be great to actually see a real world test of that. Someone running, for editing 4K video, just to see how loud it would get. And I'm sure there will be reviews that will disclose that in the coming month or so when that becomes available, which I think is mid-November.
Yeah.
So other than the more power efficient screen, the quieter fan design, obviously it's a lot thinner.
Yeah.
We've got new GPUs from AMD, which are considerably faster.
Only on the 15-inch.
Sure. Which is all most people seem to care about. I mean, why would you buy a 13? Come on. Buy a 15.
13 is perfect. No. What are you talking about?
That screen's too small.
I demand a GPU on the 13.
Preference aside, I would only buy a 15. Well, actually, I would only buy a 15-inch just because of the GPU power.
Well, I mean, luckily the 15-inch is actually much smaller than it used to be, so in theory, you could actually cram the new 15-inch MacBook Pro into a 13-inch messenger bag. In theory, I mean, if I had one, I'd test it right now. Hint, hint, Apple. But yeah, it should actually fit into smaller bags because the bezel has been shrunk. It's a lot thinner on the sides. They've really done a good job to reduce the footprint because it's not just the thickness, it's not just the weight, it's also the volume. Mm-hmm. They've decreased the volume of the product.
Speaking of volume, the Force touchpad, or what are they calling it? Force touch or 3D touch?
They call it Force touch when it's on the Mac.
It's massive.
Yes.
On the 15 inch, it's twice the size of the old trackpad.
Yes. And they can only do that because it's Force touch.
Right.
If it were still a physical button, making something that big would be extremely challenging, if not impossible.
Now, Apple claims the keyboard, this is based on the second generation version of what we had in last year's MacBook, which is the...
Yes, the butterfly key mechanism.
The butterfly key mechanism, which is one of those things where I think either you like it or you don't like it at all and you'll never use it.
I despise it, though I've heard that this new one has better travel, so it might feel better to type on. I guess I'll try one in the store and see if that pans out. I do not like the MacBook keyboard at all.
So the real star of this is clearly the OLED touch bar, which we should talk about for a while because there are all sorts of really fascinating things with it.
Yeah.
Starting with the fact that this is the first MacBook to get Touch ID.
Yes. So the touch bar, thanks to a number of discoveries by developer Steve Trodden-Smith, it turns out that the touch bar is actually an Apple Watch. The T1...
Come again? An Apple Watch in a MacBook?
Yes. The T1 chip that they announced is actually a custom modified version of the S1 chip in the original Apple Watch.
So what is this chip? Is this like the secure enclave on the iPhone?
Yes. And that's exactly why they included it. So,
and they're calling this the T1, then they didn't mention the word secure enclave.
They did mention secure enclave. They basically said this chip drives the security for Touch ID and everything. So what this chip effectively does is it puts a security firewall around the input mechanisms of the MacBook. So it locks down Touch ID, so the fingerprint data is secure and encrypted and no one can get access to it. It also locks down the FaceTime camera so that nobody can hack it and turn it on and record and keep the light off.
Okay, that's good.
It effectively locks down all of the inputs from intrusion. So this is effectively the most secure MacBook ever made. And it's all thanks to the Apple Watch. In fact, if you look at the resolution of the touch bar, it's essentially as if you took a 38 millimeter Apple Watch and stretched out the screen until it was 30 pixels tall. And there's your touch bar.
I was looking at the resolution specs on that today. I was really impressed with how high resolution it is. And I mean, obviously it's hard to tell just by looking at the videos, but when you look at somebody using it in the video, it looks like photorealistic.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly like the Apple Watch screen. It's retina, it's high color. And in fact, the UI of the touch bar basically looks like Watch OS, if you look carefully at it.
You think that's a hint of things to come? And Mac OS?
I don't know about that, but I don't know. I could see them making that touch bar larger. I could see it slowly replacing the trackpad, for example. There was actually an interesting Medium post today where somebody suggested they could replace the entire bottom half of the case with an OLED touch bar that effectively replaces the trackpad and displays like giant widgety things for different apps that you're using, which looks amazing. I don't know how they'd actually implement that, but it looks pretty cool. Though there would be some ergonomic challenges there because your wrists kind of rest there as you're typing. So that might get awkward. Though, thanks to the iPad, we have wrist detection and all of that stuff. So, I mean, all of these innovations that they make across all of their devices end up filtering back into other stuff that they do.
Yeah, I was wondering about how it works with the trackpad because I was reading Jason Snell's posts on Six Colors about the wrist, like the palm rejection on the new trackpad. So that because of the fact that it is so big, it would be so easy while you're typing to accidentally trigger it. And he said he did not change any of his habits as far as like where he rests, like how he types. And so he just typed on it like he normally would.
Yep.
And he said there were no issues whatsoever.
Yeah.
It was never accidentally triggered once.
Exactly. Because they're using the iPad's palm rejection tech. The only thing I got wrong is that sadly the touch bar does not have taptic feedback. So tapping those buttons will not feel like tapping real
buttons.
Yeah,
that'll happen next
year. Yeah, I mean,
it's just inevitable. Obvious. It's obvious.
Yeah, it's an inevitable upgrade. Yeah, so it's a really impressive device, but here's where we get to the downside. Price. They have massively increased the price of these devices to the point where in Canada, if you want to buy a base 13-inch MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar and Apple Care, you're looking at just over $2,800 after tax. And the 15-inch MacBook Pro here starts at $3,000.
These have never been, inexpensive machines, but certainly this definitely puts it out of reach for. I mean, if the 15-inch MacBook Pro wasn't already out of reach, which it is for a lot of people, to be honest, not that many people will shell out over $2,000 for a computer.
No,
that's just a reality. We're privileged that we tend to own these machines, but a lot of people, especially students, just do not want to spend that kind of money. They can't spend $3,000. On a computer. So the fact that the price has gone up this much, this is I can't even begin to say how this is going to affect sales because that's impossible to tell. And I don't want to make any assumptions that this is going to be a big problem for Apple. But this is a big deal. This is a lot more money.
I think they're falling into the trap of, well, we're not selling as many Macs as we used to, so how do we maintain revenue and profit? Oh, we'll just bump the price per unit. Either that, or if you look at graphs, we'll post a link to this graph in the show notes. The price of the entry-level MacBook Pro has actually fluctuated over time, adjusting for inflation, and this increase is actually very minimal compared to the increase that happened in 2012 when they introduced the Retina display for the first time.
Yeah.
That was very expensive at the time.
Here's what I think is going to happen, and this is why I think actually it might be less of a deal than we probably think. The new MacBook Pro is a pretty big redesign in like top to bottom, inside out.
Yeah.
All new chassis.
Yep.
They did a lot of work on this, clearly. And now, the OLED Touch Bar is an addition. Obviously, there's cost for them for the part itself, to put it in there.
Yeah.
However, there's also the thing that a lot of people don't talk about is the actual R&D, the costs for Apple to actually design and actually make this thing. So they have to, yes, they have enough cash in the bank. Anyone could say, well, they could just eat those costs. It's still probably millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars to bring this type of market to product. Oh, because even Craig Federighi said they've been working on this new design for the last several years, not just since last year.
In fact, I've heard that early prototypes of the Touch Bar were being worked on as early as 2008.
That would not surprise me at all. So I think by next year's model, we'll probably see that price come down. Just like we did with the Retina, you were saying. The price went up with the Retina models, then they came down a couple of $100, and that'll just happen. This is natural.
Yeah. Every time they introduce a major new product, the price is always insanely high. Then it comes down. Just look at the MacBook Air. Yeah. That was the same price as the MacBook is now. And then it eventually came down to that $1,000 price point.
Yeah. I mean, this is just how Apple like amortizes the cost of research and development over a period of time. And then they just drop the price.
Early adopters get hit.
Exactly.
It brings the cost down for everybody that waits. Which, of course, naturally will upset people. But, I mean, they've done this before.
Yeah.
They'll do it again. Just wait if you can't afford it.
So the other thing is that the base 13-inch model now, as far as I know, there's no MacBook in the lineup that has a spinning 5400 RPM disk anymore. It's all SSD. Correct. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So even the 13-inch model now has a 256 gigabyte SSD drive. Finally.
Yes. All flash, all the time. Yeah.
Now, if you can live without the OLED bar, which of course you can live without, you don't need it. Yes, it's a very pretty thing. But yeah, you can get into a 13-inch MacBook Pro now with an SSD. That's a nice computer.
It's
not that expensive in comparison to the rest
of them. Well, it is. It is still quite expensive. They touted it as an option for people coming up from the Air, and I don't think that's true. In Canada, it starts at $1,899. MacBook Air, you can pick up for $1,199.
That's true. The Air is a lot cheaper.
It's a huge leap. And the specs really aren't that much better. You're getting a 2 gigahertz Core i5, which is roughly equivalent to what's in the Air. It has a really high turbo boost, but that only kicks in if you're using really high intensity applications. For average use, you'll never see it go that high.
There's a huge screen difference, though. We're talking, the Airs still do not have Retina displays.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, maybe it spools up to 3.2 more often. I don't know.
Now, some people might not care about the Retina display. There are people like that.
Yeah.
My dad says that. He can't tell the difference.
Oh, you can definitely tell the difference. I mean, I don't know. Depending on eyesight, who knows?
I think the problem is he hasn't really had two side-by-side to compare a Retina and a non-Retina. I bet you he could see the difference if he had the two.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah. I have to say, yesterday I was quite upset by all of this. I was totally ready to upgrade from my Air. When they unveiled the product, I was like, wow, this is amazing. Then they announced the price. And it just completely shut me down.
Were there any gasps in the audience when the price was announced?
I'd have to go back and watch, but maybe. I don't know.
It's kind of shocking to have that price jump.
It has provoked a very virulent reaction from the Apple fan community at large.
I can only imagine what the non-Apple fans are probably saying. See, that's just that proves Apple's. They're just overhyped, overpriced products.
Well, Apple people are saying that now because of this.
It's a fair complaint.
And it's hard to disagree with them. Like, without really thinking about why this happens, you're basically led to believe, well, they're just gouging. Like, none of this is really worth what they're charging. And I mean, up to a certain point, that's true. They do have a quite large profit margin on their products. Obviously, it doesn't cost $3,000 to build a 15-inch MacBook Pro. But
I always find it funny, though, when people give whatever argument about, oh, Apple should just eat the cost of this, and oh, they don't need to charge. I'm like, they're a company. Do you understand how capitalism works? They want to make money. Yes, of course they're going to try to maximize every goddamn opportunity to make money. Now, obviously, maybe in comparison to other companies, Apple is a bit nicer about it. And yes, maybe they care about customers more and they try to do the right thing. I will agree with that. But in the end, of course, they're going to try to make as much money as possible without looking like, you know, tyrannical.
Yeah. I mean, if the 15 started at $4,000, then we'd maybe be talking about them being terrible, like really terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this,
well,
to
remember,
me,
they used to be the old PowerBook titanium. Oh, yeah. Those things were considered super, well, like, creme de la creme premium products.
I mean, that was Scully Apple. And I mean, obviously people are worried that with Tim Cook at the helm, things are looking that way again. But I mean,
I saw somebody tweet that I don't know if it was Marco Arman. I don't want to attribute it to anyone specifically, but saw some tweet where somebody said Tim Cook's a bean counter.
Yeah,
that's a pretty harsh thing to say.
That's being thrown around a lot. There was an article a little while ago that compared him to Ballmer.
Do you think that's fair to call him a bean counter?
I don't think it's fair. I think inventory is what he's really good at. That's his strength. His strength isn't really design or product.
It doesn't need to be, though.
But
he has experts for
he
that.
He does. He delegates to the other people. But what I've heard is he doesn't delegate as much as he should. He still tries to be hands-on, even though some of that stuff isn't necessarily in his wheelhouse. So, I mean, we could be seeing some friction from that kind of play out. But also, the Mac ecosystem right now is incredibly turbulent. It might not be obvious right now, but they are in the middle of a huge sea change in terms of Mac. It's easy to say, oh, they've abandoned the platform. But the thing is, they're in the middle of transforming their lineup. We are basically in a transition phase. So when all the dust settles, I think this is what it's going to look like. The MacBook is now the affordable laptop for everyone. The MacBook Pro is the more performant machine for people that need to get more complicated things done. And then the Mac Pro is the insane ultra-powered desktop for people who need to juggle 3-4K monitors at the same time and so on. So that's pretty much how it'll look. The MacBook will replace the Air. It'll hit that $1,199 price point, finally. And they'll probably bring in a 13-inch MacBook or a 14-inch MacBook, something like that. Something a bit bigger. Maybe they increase the screen. Maybe they keep it the same and just reduce the bezel and make it like a 12.5 or a 12.8-inch screen. Of course, then that starts to cannibalize into the iPad Pro, which I think they're also trying to transform. So that's the other big thing. iPad Pro in March, they're going to have new ones, and they're going to have a major update to iOS 10 that finally adds all of the productivity and UI changes we've been hoping for.
You wish.
I wish. I do know there is a big update coming for iPad.
Well, we've been talking about that off and on for a year, right?
I know.
It still hasn't happened. So
it really is happening in March, though.
2017 will be the year of the iPad.
Yes, in theory. Yeah, I don't know how big that update's going to be or what they actually change, but that is on the roadmap.
So there's obviously we're in a transition period, like you said, and it's looking like because of what's happening with Intel, that probably new iMacs, new Mac Pros announced at the same time, sometime maybe in February, possibly March, depending
yes.
on when Intel, because you said January for the new chips, the new platform.
Okay, so the problem with the Mac Pro is it relies on Intel Xeon chips, and the Intel Xeon chips for Skylake are not out. They've been delayed until quarter one 2017. So the earliest Apple is going to be able to update the Mac Pro is Q1 2017. So there are probably a ton of Mac Pro chassis, logic boards, other parts that they've decided on, just sitting around at Foxconn waiting for Apple to get that shipment in from Intel and then solder the CPUs on. Like, there's probably a whole warehouse full of Mac Pros waiting to be assembled with those chips once Intel finally gets their act together and ships them. So I know people are disappointed about the Mac Pro, but Apple literally isn't able to update them right now. That's the thing. They have to wait on Intel. So if you want to be angry at somebody, be angry at Intel, because they've continually delayed their chips over and over and over again. Their roadmap looks like Swiss cheese the number of times they've had to delay and change and cut and do whatever they're doing. So, I mean, yeah, you could argue, well, just use the same chip and then make all the other changes, but that's not how Apple works. They build a system around the chip, not the other way around. So they need those new chips to make everything else work. So yeah, that's kind of just how it is. And hopefully Intel will ship those chips, and then we'll get an event in the spring where we get to see the new iPad Pro, iOS 10.3 with all the crazy iPad changes, or 10.2. I don't know when 10.2 is going to ship. If it doesn't ship by February, that'll be the big iPad update probably. And then, yeah, they'll also announce a spec bump to the iMac and the new Mac Pro. And that'll be the spring event for Apple.
So is there anything else that we're missing from the Thursday announcement? There was nothing about... Okay. The MacBook Airs had a minor...
No.
Bump. Did they?
They had nothing.
No? Nothing?
They actually killed the 11-inch MacBook Air. There is only the 13-inch now. Yeah.
Well, their lineup, that's not entirely surprising because the lineup was getting a bit busy.
Yes.
Right? And it might have been a sales thing. Like, obviously, Apple has their own... They have access to their data.
Well,
they can tell.
Yeah.
Like, if it just isn't selling as well...
Yeah. I mean, there are some people who love the 11-inch MacBook Air, but the thing is... That's why the 12-inch MacBook exists. Yes, it still costs a lot right now, but next year it likely won't.
Next year it'll be what? 2 years on the... We've had two revisions.
It'll be the third MacBook that's released.
Right.
So my guess is right now it's like $1,649 for the cheapest one. My guess is next year that'll drop to around $1,300, which puts it within striking distance of the Air. And at that point, it starts to look like a viable alternative. And then we'll probably see people start to upgrade because then it's like, well, for $100 to $200 more, I could get the Retina display and it's lighter and thinner and it's just as fast and all these other things. So we'll start to see that happen next year. So at that point, the Air could... I don't know. I think it'll probably survive another year. They might bump it a bit. And then 2018, the MacBook will finally be cheap enough to totally kill the Air. And then they'll just have MacBook Pro. And that's it. Back to the way it used to be, effectively. Because they always used to just have the MacBook and the MacBook Pro. Yeah. And that was it. So, yeah. Then I guess we can talk about Microsoft.
You want to try to pack Microsoft?
Well, I mean, Microsoft only announced one thing.
Okay, so let's quickly touch on
it. You know, well, they announced two things, but, three things. Okay, so they announced a major new upgrade to Windows 10 that's free for everyone. It adds a bunch of stuff, some crazy 3D things, this new way of integrating all of your social networks together. You can read emails and then instantly reply to someone in Skype in the same window and all this nutty other stuff. That'll be available in the spring. Early builds will be available to Windows insiders soon. Then they announced a new i7 Surface Book, way more powerful than the current one. It also costs a lot more than the current one. That Surface Book is about $3,000 to $4,000, depending on configuration. So, I mean, if you're complaining about the MacBook Pro, just take a look at what Microsoft just announced and compare the price. Not that bad, guys.
Right. The one that's most interesting to me is the Studio.
Yes. So this was the big reveal from Microsoft. They announced the Surface Studio, which is a 27-inch all-in-one computer with a just insane, slightly less than 5K, 3x2 screen with DCI P3 color. They've also added support for swapping color modes in Windows 10, so you can snap back to sRGB to see what something would look like for people with normal monitors. And looks kind of like an iMac, except...
Oh, really? I mean, I guess...
It's made of aluminum.
Sure.
It's got a black glass screen.
The bottom, though, the part where I think the actual computer is, kind of reminds me of a Mac Mini on the bottom with a monitor and a hinge on top.
So where they differ, instead of packing all the electronics into the screen and just having a stand, they've taken the step of putting all the electronics into a box that forms the stand for the screen. So the screen is incredibly thin and it just kind of floats on this hinge that's connected to the main computer.
And it needed to be for what they show in the commercial.
Yes. So this was the big surprise. First, they started talking about it like it was a regular all-in-one computer. Then they got to the part that I always knew they were going to get to, and that was you can pivot the damn thing down.
With a single finger.
With a single finger, you can pivot the whole thing on its axis so that it becomes a giant touchscreen drafting
now,
cable.
This is like a proper multi-touch screen, is it not?
Yes, it's a multi-touch screen.
It's a big deal for
10
something
fingers,
that big.
And it has Surface Pen support, so you've got the pressure sensitivity and all of that stuff.
What was that little puck thing that they put on the screen?
Right.
That thing like blew my mind.
That. So full Surface Pen support, so you can draw. Like, this is the machine for illustrators.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Animators,
bar none.
I mean, you wouldn't need a Cintiq for anymore.
Yeah, like, and it costs a lot. It costs about $3,000. But the thing is,
a Cintiq's expensive.
A Cintiq is $2,800. And then you have to buy a computer to connect to it on top of that.
And it's not that great. Not anywhere near this level of quality.
Yeah. Like, I heard someone, I think it was Gabe on Penny Arcade in his article, he described drawing on a Cintiq as like trying to draw through a moldy cellophane window or something.
That's not a good testimony.
I don't know if it was him. It might have been somebody else. But yeah, someone described it like that. And So, I mean, you could draw on that, or you could draw on this insane, effectively massive 5K iMac panel. And then the other thing they announced was the Surface Dial, which is a rotary physical control that allows you to zoom in and out and do various other things. But then here's the kicker. You can put it directly on the Surface Studio screen, and it blows out radial touch controls around it. The Surface Studio actually detects the position of the dial and extends UI controls from underneath it.
It felt like some Tony Stark shit right there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it looked really cool.
It's very cool. And it builds on the tech that they actually had in the original Surface Table. Because the original Surface Table could actually...
Yeah.
Recognize devices and objects that were placed on it. So the same tech has to be at play here, where it might be an NFC chip or something like that. You place the dial on and the system knows exactly where it's positioned. And then it's able to bring up the alternate controls. So for one example, you can use it as a giant color wheel, literally turning the colors from
really
red
awesome.
Through green, through blue.
Yeah, designers are going to, they're going to love this.
This is an insane tool for designers.
And it just makes I still love the iMac, but when you see stuff like that, it just makes the iMac look old. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And you're not the only one. A lot of people are saying that. And the thing is, as much as Apple has gone on about how touchscreens are bad for desktops,
I don't believe it.
Microsoft solved that with this device. You just pivot it down. At that point, it's incredibly easy to use as a touchscreen. Because do you know what else pivots at that angle? An iPad. If it's got a smart cover rolled up into that triangle and you just put it on a desk.
How is an iPad Pro any more comfortable?
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is the thing. They're dying on this hill of, we can never put a touchscreen on a desktop or a laptop. But the thing is,
it's going to happen with Apple, because they said the same thing about the stylus. My God, for how many years? And then they put a stylus in the iPad Pro.
To be fair about that, Jobs was talking about the operating system needing a stylus.
Okay, fine. Like, iOS doesn't need it.
Yeah.
Right.
He wasn't talking about, anyways, if you ever have a stylus, it's terrible.
I think Mac OS is getting long in the tooth.
Yeah.
I think we need a multi-touch desktop OS somehow.
Yeah.
And I think the OLED touch bar is a precursor to that.
It's, I don't know.
It feels like Apple's just like, we'll stick one toe in the multi-touch like desktop pond, but we're not quite, they don't really want to go there.
Yeah. I think they're basically hoping that iOS will start to take over. I think that's the plan. The problem is they didn't really focus on iPad at all. Like, iPad is still very much a giant iPod.
Sorry, guys. Finder is not going away with 5 gigs of free iCloud storage. You want iCloud? You want iCloud document syncing to take over the world? And yeah, you cannot put 5 gigabytes as the. It's like, people need to put their shit somewhere.
Yeah,
and they're not going to pay for it.
Well, I mean,
for the most part,
but. I think we'll see that change. I think the plan is to have iOS take over, and hopefully in the spring we will see the beginning of that with a major update to iPad. And then we can start to talk about, well, given this update, it's obvious that the iPad is now going to begin to eat the Mac from the bottom upward. And then Mac OS will kind of stay as it is and not necessarily change a ton. And it'll just be like incremental until eventually iOS just eats the whole thing up. And then we're all using iPads that connect to various peripherals and plug into docks and whatever the hell else. Or not even plug into things. It'll just be like wireless AirPlay to things and so on. W1 chips everywhere. I think things are just frustrating now because Apple is kind of moving their chess pieces into position, and we haven't really seen what that position is yet exactly. So right now on the ground, it seems very confusing and frustrating, but I think we'll start to get some clarity over the next 12 months as they start to update these things and kind of show their hand a bit more. So stay tuned. And if you absolutely can't afford the new MacBook Pro, just wait for the mid-2017 release with Kaby Lake. That'll be way cheaper and faster, and hopefully the battery life will get a bump.
You've been listening to The Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. And if you'd like to show your support for this podcast and what we do here, the best way to do that is to become a monthly sustaining donator. And you can do that right now by going to patreon.com/hologramradio and give a buck or two, whatever you feel you can part with. It really does make a difference here. Subscribe to the podcast in iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week, or your podcast player of choice. We're available in Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and pretty much everywhere where podcasts matter. We would also sincerely appreciate a review if you can take a moment to do that. It helps other people find the show. We're on Twitter at The Impromptu, or Michael Norton individually is at Zen Impulse. I'm Zero Distraction. We're on Facebook, Instagram, subscribe everywhere, because why not? And if you'd like to send feedback to either of us the old-fashioned way, send an email to theimpromptu@hologramradio.org.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.